Focus on the Beer. I'm Ryan Hannigan. I'm here with my co-host, Josh Howard. And we are here with Keith Villa, who many of you may know as the founder and the sort of creator of Blue Moon prior to Coors taking it over. But he's got a new book out there, Brewing with Cannabis. And we got a chance to read it, and we've got him on the line here to sort of talk about his experiences in the beer industry, writing this book, and then also just sort of the future for his new brewing company, Saria Brewing Company. So, Keith, welcome to the show.
Hi, Ryan. Hi, Josh. Thanks, guys, for having me on. My pleasure, and hopefully we can have some fun tonight for your listeners.
Yeah,
hopefully, because we haven't been delivering fun for a while.
we definitely haven't. I'm actually just pouring out a little bit of the Indie Wave hoppy one. I don't have the THC version.
Is it the infused one with cannabis?
No, I just have the non-alcoholic ones. I haven't had a chance to get over to the actual dispensaries to get an infused one yet, but we at least have the base to taste things. Is the recipe different for the THC infused ones, or is it pretty much the same?
No, it's the same base beer. It's just that some of it goes to our co-packing facility where it gets infused with cannabis. But yeah, exact same beer, whether it's the Belgian White or the IPA. And that's what makes it fun, because people can go buy the non-infused versions, try those, and if they want, they can go to the dispensaries and buy the infused.
Yeah, it's super cool. One thing I did notice that I wanted to ask about before Josh jumps in, sorry. These are brewed at Sleeping Giant, but then it says it's canned in Matt by Matt Brewing. Is that FX Matt up in Utica?
We've got several co-packers and contract brewers we work with. So what we do is here in Arvada, Colorado, we have our pilot brewery in our offices and our headquarters, and then we have contract brewers across the United States with each different geography to brew the beer and de-alcoholize it and either get it to the market right in those geographies, those regions, as non-infused NA beer, or we package it up and then send it to our co-packers to infuse it with cannabis for the markets where it's legal.
Awesome.
So my question was going to be specifically about that co-packing term that you used. I know for you, your main brewery is located in Arvada, Colorado, correct?
Mm-hmm. Well, our pilot brewery, yeah.
Now is... Okay. And is Arvada... Is that a place where... You know, I know certain metro districts can make a decision as far as whether or not... cannabis can be sold within their city limits. Colorado Springs, for instance, where Ryan and I are, does not allow it. I know Denver does, but what's the situation with Arvada? Is that why you have to have a co-packer, is because you can't do it on site there?
Correct. So Arvada has a moratorium, like Colorado Springs, where it's illegal to work with cannabis and to sell cannabis in the city limits. So we, although our headquarters is here, and we're crossing our fingers, and we're hopeful that the city council will change the regulations as we move forward. But at this point in time, it is not allowed in the city of Arvada. So as beautiful a city it is, and as beautiful as Colorado Springs is, unfortunately, you cannot buy cannabis products in those two cities.
Is there an actual tap room in Arvada, or is it just the headquarters?
No, we as a brewery, we don't have a tap room because what we decided early on is, if you remember, I'm sure you two have been to Falling Rock Tap House over the years before it closed, and Chris Black and his brothers ran a fantastic establishment, having nothing but the best craft brewed beers. But one thing early on that he saw was that when breweries open up tap rooms, it is essentially competition for the retailers who sell the same products. And then when you sell more varied products on site, for example, you have a guest tap, you've got other brewers where you're selling then your head-to-head competition with your retailers. And Chris Black made that known loud and clear over the years. And so that has always stuck with me, as well as my years at Coors. I remember all that philosophy was, okay, we're not going to compete with you, the retailer. We're going to provide beers. And so our philosophy is that same philosophy. It's like, okay, you retailers who sell our beers, awesome. Thank you for buying our beers to sell to the public. We're not going to have a tap room where people can come, pay for the beers and even some exclusive beers. If they want our beers, they have to go to the retailers and buy them there. Whether it's Buffalo Wild Wings or any independent establishment, that's where they go to taste our beers. Whether it's our an NA beers, Saria beers, or we do also have an alcoholic division of our company called Donovan Brewing, where we test alcoholic recipes. We make beers like, we've got a mojito ale beer that tastes like a mojito cocktail. We've got a horchata beer. We've got a with cinnamon. We've got a wine beer hybrid beer. We've got all kinds of cool beers, but if people want those, they've got to go to the retailer. They can't come to our place, because we made that decision years ago that, you know, if you want to have our beers, go to the retailers, you know, go to their places, support them, because they carry our beers.
That's a really interesting mode, because I feel like a lot of breweries these days, especially ones that their package, they try to emphasize their own tap room almost more than their distribution, which, you know, seems a little backwards sometimes, and it sounds like you guys sort of came to that sort of same conclusion and put the emphasis on the places that are already buying your beers.
Yeah, for us it's because for us it's a very simple decision. It's like, okay, if people love our beers, go and support the retailers who carry them. We won't have, yes, we do have a small tap room on site, but it's only for those retailers to come in and special guests. So for example, if you two you know, wanted to come over, you could come over and try some of the beers on tap. Retailers can, but it's not open to the public. It's because, again, our philosophy is, if you want our beers, go to the retailers that carry them, because those retailers, you know, if they invest in us in that way, it's like, let's support them and their staffs, because you've got servers, you've got the bartenders, and, you know, they need to make money. And, you know, yes, as a brewery, we need to make money too. But for us, we want to support all of those retailers who had the guts at the beginning to carry our products. So, yes, that's why we support them 100%. And we're not aware of a lot of other companies that do that. So we're definitely, you know, in the minority when it comes to not having a tap room and telling all of our fans to go to those retailers and support them.
Speaking of your catalog of beers, can you tell us what particular styles you're brewing, and if you've got any additional styles planned for the future?
Yeah, so on the, what we do is we have a business where we have Saria Brewing Company, which is 100% non-alcoholic, and then we have Saria Infused, which is the non-alcoholic with cannabis, and then we have on the other side Donovan, which is alcoholic. That's where we test alcoholic recipes, and if we find them doing really well, then we convert those, or we try to convert them into non-alcoholic versions for Saria. So right now we've got we have a really nice Vienna style lager that's doing very well, and we'd love to turn that into a non-alcoholic, because I love Vienna styles. They're really nice and real flavorful, easy to drink, and just a really nice expression of lagers without being too light, too dark. It's kind of right in the middle. It's kind of a Goldilocks beer. It's just about right.
Yeah, right. Right, the sweet spot.
Yeah.
So Keith, for our listeners that don't know a whole lot about Saria Brewing and maybe don't know about the history of Blue Moon, walk us through sort of your history in beer and how you came to owning a, you know, a THC infused beverage company, essentially.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. How many hours do we have?
just a quick overview.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, I am a native of Colorado. I grew up, I was born in Wheat Ridge at Lutheran Hospital, and I grew up in Arvada, went to Pomona High School in Arvada, and then my undergrad was in molecular biology at the University of Colorado in Boulder, and that's where I was planning on becoming a pediatrician. So I had worked real hard to get into medical school, and but by the time I was ready to graduate from my undergraduate studies at Boulder, Coors was looking for someone to do research in brewing at their brewery. So I looked at that, and I happened to be a home brewer in college because in those days, you guys are probably way too young to remember, but home brewing used to be illegal up until 1978. It was absolutely illegal. You couldn't brew it. And then in 1978, under President Jimmy Carter, that's when home brewing became legalized. And so I was in college at University of Colorado, and it was about 1982, I think. So it was just a few years after legalization. And the Brewers Association, AHA, American Homebrewers Association, was established up in Boulder. And that's where I went to school. And of course, all the students, you know, go to the Pearl Street Mall, which is this fun walking mall. You see everybody from, I don't know, Hare Krishnas to Jesus freaks to jugglers and everything. And but at the end of the mall was the Brewers Association headquarters. And I remember they were handing out pamphlets, and there were all kinds of cool things in regards to learn how to home brew. And so I thought, this sounds like fun. And so I picked up a pamphlet, and I said, you know, this, I didn't realize you can make your beer at home. And so I started learning how to home brew in my dorm, and found out that you could make beer. Well, it wasn't anything to write home about, but it was alcoholic. You could get a buzz off it, and I thought, this is cool. And so yeah, I did that. And by the time I graduated, I was ready to go to medical school, but Coors was looking for someone to do research. And I thought, well, beer is kind of fun. And they were looking for a researcher, and I had done a lot of gene cloning and stuff that they were looking for to improve their yeast strains. And so I thought, I'm going to give this a try. And I went and I talked to them, and there were a bunch of students at CU who went to, you know, talk to them about this position they were looking to fill. And I was the most qualified because I had co-authored a couple of articles as an undergrad, and realized I was working hard to get into medical school. That's what you did in those days. Actually, nowadays too, you work hard if you want to become a doctor. So I did all kinds of stuff to try to get into medical school, and Coors liked all that, and they said, you know, this is great. We'd love to have you the day after you graduate. And so that's when I had to go back to my dorm room and say, you know, do I want to work with sick people or beer? I thought, well, I'll try beer for just a year, maybe two. If I don't like it, I'm going to go to medical school. So I went, and it turns out that I loved working with beer and doing research. And so I was there for 2 years at Coors. And then after that, I said, I'm going to quit and go back to Boulder and get my PhD in biochemistry. This is really fun. And they said, well, hold on. What if we send you to Belgium to get your PhD in brewing? Because the director of research happened to know a professor in Belgium who had an opening for a doctoral student. And it took me just a fraction of a second to say, yes, I'm going to go to Belgium and get my PhD in brewing. So I went and got my doctorate. And at that time, my girlfriend, we were high school sweethearts. We ended up getting married, and Belgium became our honeymoon, and we're still married to this day. I always introduce her as my first wife, but she's been with me ever since, and she's one of the very few people I can trust when I create a new beer to taste it and tell me, do you like it or not, and what do you not like about it, or what do you like about it? She has a very good palate. But we spent time in Belgium, 4 years, where I got my PhD in brewing. And went back, to Coors, and Belgium is socialized as a country. For those of your listeners who don't realize it, but everything is, well, public things are paid for, like education. My yearly tuition to get a PhD was $98. So $98, less than $100 tuition per year to get a PhD in brewing. So it's just crazy. So a four-year PhD in brewing was less than $500. I mean, that's crazy. So, but Coors paid it. I came back, and that's when I convinced Coors to give me funding to start Blue Moon, because they already had two new products that were huge in America. Their biggest one was called Zima. It was the forerunner to today's, that's hard seltzers.
Seltzer beers,
Yes. And then the other product they had was the number one selling craft beer in 1995. It was called George Killian's Irish Red. And for your listeners who may not remember, that was a huge, huge brand back in the 90s. And so Coors had those two.
As a college student in the 90s, yes, it was.
And so I convinced them to give me funding to start this new entity, which was called Blue Moon. And they gave me funding. They did not let me brew it in Golden, Colorado. I had to find a place that had capacity. So found a place up in New York, upstate New York, the FX Map Brewing Company in Utica. And that's where I launched Blue Moon back in 1995. And it was tough because the folks at Coors didn't quite understand what I was doing with these Belgian beers that were cloudy and, crazy, brewed with orange peel, coriander. Back then, that was considered crazy. And but I did. I pushed forward. The higher management people at Coors tried several times to kill off Blue Moon, which is, it's well documented. They really did. They tried to kill it off because they didn't quite understand what it was that I was doing. And I fought to keep it alive. I created the orange slice garnish in 1997 to make Blue Moon stand out in a crowd and in a bar. I created that iconic glass in 1998 so to showcase the cloudiness and color of Blue Moon and with the orange slice garnish. And it wasn't until 2001 that Blue Moon reached critical mass and started taking off and became what it is today. But it was a lot of work. And over the years, it grew and became the biggest craft beer brand in the United States and in the world, which it still is today. And the success of Blue Moon allowed me to retire from Coors back in 2018. And so actually, it was the end of 2017. And that's when my wife and I decided to get into cannabis and thought, we're going to bring cannabis to the masses in a socially acceptable format, which is beer, because we didn't want to open up a dispensary. We didn't want to create vape pens or anything like that. We thought, let's make it drinkable like beer and get rid of the alcohol and have beers that have THC. And so we found out quickly that there were three major hurdles we had to cross. The first was, we found out that you can't mix cannabis and alcohol. So I had to create recipes with non-alcoholic beers that tasted good. So I did that. And then we had to figure out, how do you put cannabis into beer when cannabis is like hops, very, very oily? How do you put an oil into a water solution and make it, water soluble? We figured that out. And then last thing was, how do you make a brand? How do you create a brand that resonates with people? And we finally got that done. And so, Saria, the name Saria is, and if you look at our cans, Saria, the name comes from Ceres, the Roman goddess of agriculture. Her profile adorns our labels. That's Ceres, the Roman goddess of agriculture. And we thought, what better person to be on our logos than her? Because whether you're talking cannabis, hops, or barley, or wheat, she was the goddess of agriculture. So we thought, that's perfect. Plus, the name Saria is also the name of the campus where the brewing school is located in Belgium. So if you go to the Seria campus, you'll see the brewing school, you'll see the chocolate making school, the hotel restaurant management school. All those food industry schools are on that campus. And in French, it's an acronym that stands for the Center for Teaching and Research in the Food Industries. So that's what Seria stands for. That's how we got the name, and we launched, and we got into the cannabis market right away. And then in 2020, during COVID, that's when we decided to pivot just a little bit and start offering our beers without cannabis, without infusion, for the general market, because we had such a strong demand from people saying, you know, I love the beer, but I get tested for drugs. Can you sell it without the infusion? And so we did in 2020, which is, from a business perspective, it was probably the dumbest thing to do, is to launch a product during COVID, the pandemic, but we did. And we've kept growing everything since then. And so now we have our non-infused, non-alcoholic beer that's in the general market, and our infused beers, which are these ones that you find only in dispensaries. You can see they're two very different looking labels. This is the general market. Actually, this is our IPA. Let me get the IPA. Here's the IPA cannabis one. You see, it's completely different. Here the IPA is a blue label with a green band. Here for the cannabis market, you see the cannabis warnings, you see the green label, and you also have a child resistant top on the cannabis products, where on the regular one, it's just a standard pop top. So there's a lot of ways to distinguish between the cannabis version and the non-infused version for the general market. So some people say, oh, am I drinking my beer with cannabis? And it's like, no, if it's from the general market, you're not, because it's so highly regulated in the cannabis world. There's no way you can find this ever in the general market. You have to go to a dispensary, you have to show your ID to prove you're 21, and you'll see all these warning labels all over the place, as well as stickers. The dispensaries put stickers everywhere to keep track of it, because it's highly, highly regulated. And here we are 2 hours later. That's my short story.
No, that's great. Fantastic. You know, the one thing that I thought was one of the more fascinating chapters in the Brewing with Cannabis book was the regulatory chapter, speaking on the differences that each state had, and just the in-depth analysis that you went into, just showing how the difference between like California and Colorado allow certain, even just terms, to be on the beer was fascinating.
Oh, it's crazy, because as your listeners know, in the world of cannabis, it's federally illegal. So the federal government does not put any regulations in place for suppliers to follow. So it's up to each state to do that. So because of that, you have different regulations in every state. And that's what makes it so difficult now if you want to get into the cannabis business, is you have to follow the rules in every state, and they're all different. So I try to lay those out in the book, because when I wrote the book, I asked people what they wanted in the book, and I only had a 10,000 word limit, and the title was there because the Brewers Publications, they wanted a really catchy, really cool title, and Brewing with Cannabis, you know, is a catch-all title that really encompasses everything. So I had those things there, and craft brewers wanted so many different things. You can imagine talking to craft brewers, because you guys talk to craft brewers all the time, and craft brewers, some wanted the book to have as much as possible about the regulations. You know, what's allowed from a sales and marketing standpoint? How do you label the products? How do you sell them? And others wanted to know the legalities. Oh, what's legal? What's not legal? And homebrewers wanted recipes. They said, I want to recreate some of these cool things at home. How do I do that? And then other people had no clue about cannabis. They said, you know, I've heard about it, I never tried it. What's the history of cannabis? You know, what's the plant? You know, is it similar to hops? And so with that, I tried to dedicate each chapter to certain topics. The first chapter is really kind of the history of cannabis and why it became illegal. Then I have a couple chapters on the biology and agronomy of cannabis plants, how to grow them at home, how to harvest, how to make the cannabinoids water soluble. I have a chapter on recipes where you can look at some of the historic cannabis recipes as well as some modern ones, and as well as quite a few of my homebrew recipes. And then I have some on the sales and marketing, the legalities, all these different things. I tried to cover as much as possible for the first work, modern work, on cannabis. So, and I've heard back from quite a few people who are using it as a guideline to get into the business or just to be fascinated by how complex it is.
Well, it truly was fascinating just seeing all the different options and how it all fit together.
Yeah,
can you elaborate a little bit more on why you? Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, can you elaborate a little bit more on why you can't mix alcohol with THC? I know the non-alcoholic line, of course, has been a good offshoot of this, and I know Ryan has said he's definitely a fan of the NA versions of the beer, at the very least. But for our listeners, you know, why is there that separation between THC and alcohol in the product?
Okay, there's a few reasons, and I spell them out in the book, but for the benefit of your listeners, number one, it's federally illegal to put anything that's illegal into an alcoholic beverage. So whether you're talking cannabis or crystal meth, you can't put that into an alcoholic beverage. So that's federally illegal to put something that's illegal into alcohol. At the state level, where cannabis is legal, it's illegal at the state level to put alcohol into any cannabis beverage. So at the federal level and the state level, you've got both of them saying, okay, you cannot mix the two. So it is illegal there. Now, at the scientific level, there's so many unknowns that you just don't want to mix the two together, because I go into detail in the book on a few of the things, but the big example is in the 1990s, you saw the advent of Red Bull and vodka. And then the brewers got into it by offering these beers that had alcohol and caffeine, because it was, you know, people wanted to stay up all night partying and they didn't want to get tired and go to sleep. And so what you ended up with was drinks like Four Loko, Sparks, and these drinks that had high amounts of alcohol and caffeine to keep people up all night. And so you had wide awake drunks. and of course, what happened was eventually people started getting sick. You had heart arrhythmias. You had all these different things, because when you mix alcohol and caffeine, it's not good for the body. And if you are awake, you do crazy things. I mean, some people you had drunk people doing, you had date rapes. You had all just kind of terrible things happening. And so the FDA stepped in and they said, okay, they issued a letter saying, get these things off the shelf because it's a public nuisance. These things are not working. Get them off the shelf immediately. So the brewers had to pull these products off the shelf and had to reformulate without caffeine. And so that was one aspect where you had people who, you know, drank coffee in the morning and maybe in the evening they had a beer and they thought, oh, I can mix these with no problem. But in fact, there were problems. And it's the same thing with cannabis. Right now, there's so many unknowns. We don't know how the different cannabinoids, and in the plant, there are more than 100 cannabinoids, but we are pretty much familiar with THC and CBD, but there's a lot more that we're not familiar with. And they could do all kinds of crazy things. They could interact with your prescription medication. They could interact with alcohol in maybe a good way, maybe a bad way. We just don't know. That's why in the book, I lay out a bunch of these things and I say, please use caution, because as homebrewers, you know, homebrewers are, to me, homebrewers are the ultimate innovators, because they'll try anything. And for them, when they try things in the book, I say, please use caution, because if you mix cannabis and alcohol, you don't know what will happen. So be very careful. But the thing we can say is that there are a couple things that we do know. Cannabis is used by cancer patients who are on chemo because it minimizes the dry heaves. If they're on chemo, you know, they're throwing up hundreds of times a day. And what cannabis does is it stimulates that nerve in the back of your throat. So if you stick your finger down your throat, you gag, you have that gag reflex because there's a nerve called the vagus nerve. And you're touching that nerve and it makes you want to throw up. But on cannabis, that nerve gets stimulated so it's not sensitive anymore. And you could, if you're on cannabis, high on cannabis, you can try to make yourself throw up, and it's hard because that nerve doesn't want to react. So now picture yourself at a party, and say you're in college and you think that, you know, you're invincible and you're like a Superman or a Superwoman at a party. And it's like, oh, I can take shots of tequila. And so without cannabis, you might have, you know, with your friends, 5 shots, 6 shots, and all of a sudden you get this feeling, and it's like, I gotta find a toilet real quick. And you go throw up because your body says, hey, there's a bunch of tequila in there that I gotta get rid of because it's poison if it gets into my blood system. But on cannabis, that doesn't happen because that, you know, your nerve is stimulated back there, and it's like, oh man, I could gulp down that whole bottle. And you can gulp down a whole bottle of tequila. And it's like, come on, now I'll go for a bottle of rum or whatever. And you can imagine that your blood alcohol level could go sky high with tragic consequences. And so that's just one example. And we just don't know everything about cannabis. So that's why anybody that wants to get into it, please use caution, because there are some people with a lot of experience that use both cannabis and alcohol at the same time. And you can have some interesting, I would say somewhat pleasurable experiences at low, low levels when you cross the two. In fact, the term is called cross-fading because it's where you get a slight buzz and a slight high at the same time. It's cross-fading. But if you get too much, you can get couch-locked really quick, where you just won't go into the fetal position on the couch and you're there for 3, 4, 5 hours and you just don't want to get up. And it's a feeling that you don't want to have because it doesn't feel good. And by the way, you're that guy at a party that everybody looks at and says, he had way too much. And you never want to be that guy or that girl.
True. Do you think that if cannabis were to be legalized at a federal level, that would obviously open up, you know, removing it off Schedule 1, where, you know, I personally don't believe it belongs anyway, that would open up a lot of research opportunities that would then, you know, you mentioned 100 different cannabinoids that maybe don't have any research, we don't know what they do. You know, what's the immediate benefit to that sort of legalization? Is it the research, or does that, you know, increase market, or both, or talk to me about that.
Yeah, no, that's a fantastic question, Josh, because yes, with federal, and I should back up and say, cannabis was made a Schedule 1 drug with no research. It was, and I cover that in the book. It was done because of political reasons, racial reasons, mm-hmm. threat to profits. So it was done based on all those things, not on science. It wasn't done because it's a highly addictive drug or any of those definitions of a Schedule 1 DEA drug. So it was none of that.
Thanks,
was
Nixon.
Involved. Well, actually, it goes way before Nixon, back to the 1930s, a gentleman named Anslinger. And that's covered in the book. But yeah, so it is a Schedule 1. If it were made federally legal, my personal opinion is that you will see universities step in right away to do as much research as possible to find out as much about these 100 cannabinoids and patent them, because universities are so good at that. They patent things to make money for the university, and then they license that technology to the industry. And you will see that so fast. You'll see University of Colorado, down in Colorado Springs where you guys are, up in Boulder where I am, you'll see CSU, you'll see Harvard, you'll see Princeton, Yale. Universities across the country will race to do research to patent the effects of these cannabinoids. because there are so many of them that are rumored to be just like caffeine, but not caffeine. Things that are like Viagra, but it's not Viagra. All these crazy cannabinoids that do these things, and you're going to find universities stepping in to do the research as well as private industry. And, you know, because it's to me, it's all about money. It's like you follow the money trail to see what's going to happen or what happened. You do that. I don't care what industry you're talking about. Follow the money and you'll learn so much. It, here with cannabis, when it becomes federally legal, and it's not a matter of if, it's when. Because in my view, it's sometime between now and 2024 legislative session, it's going to become legal. And but once it does, you're going to see private industry and universities jump in, and they're going to be patenting left and right. And they're going to do that to make money. And then you're going to find products out there that are novel and cool and will give you the experience that you want. Things like there are things in cannabis that give you the munchies. So it's like, okay, those people who are maybe in nursing homes and they're no longer hungry, or people with cancer who have lost their appetite, give them these cannabinoids, and man, they will be on the phone to Papa John's saying, give me a large pepperoni pizza, and they'll start eating again. You'll find the cannabinoids that make you not hungry, that you're satiated. And so those are the perfect diet drug. It's like, okay, you know, here's a cannabinoid you can take that won't make you hungry, you'll feel full. And it's like, okay, it's natural, it comes from a plant. And if Harvard patents that, they can make a lot of money with that diet drug. And everything, I mean, the one that acts like caffeine, there's no caffeine, but it's a cannabinoid that makes your body awake. And it's like, oh man, I've got to study for this test, or I've got to stay up because I'm a truck driver driving, you know, I only can drive eight hours a day, but in those 8 hours, I get tired. I got to stay awake. And so, yeah, you're going to see so much innovation come around when it becomes federally legalized.
That's going to be super, super interesting. Talk us through the brewing process for, you talked earlier about transitioning a beer from being an alcoholic version of a beer to being a non-alcoholic version of beer. What process do you have to take as a brewer to make sure that transition happens sort of fluidly without like the flavor changing too much on you?
Okay, so the first thing is, without alcohol, it is very difficult, because alcohol provides so much of a sensory aspect to beer. And when you remove the alcohol, the beer immediately feels thin and watery, and it's a drastic change. So as a brewer, you have to compensate for that. You have to do things in the brew house during fermenting. There's so many different things. And then it depends on how you make your non-alcoholic beer. In the book, I talk about the different ways that you can do that. Big brewers might use mechanical ways like vacuum distillation or reverse osmosis or other membrane technologies. Or they may use novel yeast strains or arrested fermentation. Homebrewers can use arrested fermentation. Homebrewers can use distillation, and homebrewers can use novel yeast strains. So whether you're a small home brewer, a craft brewer, or a big brewer, there are a number of ways for you to make non-alcoholic beer. And each way can make a satisfactory tasting beer. You just have to make sure you cover all the bases to get the body right, the mouthfeel, the foam, and really just the look and appearance of the beer. And from a home brewer's perspective, the way I recommend is to either do a fully fermented home brew with a lower starting gravity, and then boil off that alcohol at 173 degrees. Or you can use novel yeast strains as a home brewer, and those will work. You just have to use a really high temperature mashing procedure to get as much maltose and maltotriose in the brew as possible, because those novel yeast strains don't ferment glucose. So you want to really minimize any glucose. And so it's when you take those avenues, you can make some decent tasting non-alcoholic beers. But like I said, you have to compensate for the body, the foam.
Yeah, it's really interesting. There's a lot of different options out there, and I feel like some of them don't compensate for those losses that the alcohol gives it. I do have to say, I'm sitting here. I've had four of the Saria Brewing non-alcoholic beers so far, and they're great. They're super tasty. They taste to me. I've been drinking this summer pretty much, so they taste pretty much what I remember beer tasting like. So it's a really refreshing thing to not have this watery, overly hoppy gunk.
Well, thanks, Ryan. Yeah. We at this point we have two styles, or some people say flavors, but we've got a Belgian white and an IPA. I'm drinking the IPA, and I designed them as a brewmaster. I designed them to smell and taste like beer, because that's it, at the end of the day, that's what people want. Is if you're selling something that's supposed to be like a beer, it should look like it and taste like it. And so yeah, our products look and taste like beer, but to me, it really is important to deliver that, because there are so many people that are looking for a product to help them pace themselves. Like, say on a Friday night, you're out with all your friends. You don't want to get drunk and then drive home. You want to be responsible. If you have a buzz or something, you don't want to go past that relaxing buzz. You don't want to go past it and get drunk. And so our beers allow people to pace themselves. Or if you want a weekend without alcohol, and we see a lot of people who are sober curious, they say, what's it like to spend this weekend without alcohol? Because they've grown up their whole life with alcohol. And for them, it's like, okay, I'm gonna drink a non-alcoholic beer. I'm gonna go out, I'm gonna have fun and see what it's like to, to go dancing, to go have fun, go to a concert, but not be drunk so I can remember everything. And there are so many people like that. And for them, it's like, it's awesome from my perspective, because we make a product with zero alcohol. And in our current label, it says non-alcoholic and it says less than 0.5, but our beers actually come in at 0.0%. So ours is a true alcohol-free beer. We have new labels coming out this fall that really reflect that it's 0.0. So, and it's hard to make a 0.0 beer that tastes good, that has the body and look of a beer. And it's funny, because you tell people, I tell people, and we even have beer coasters for our products that have the comparison. It says one ripe banana has more alcohol than a six pack of our beer. So it's just crazy.
I'm getting drunk on bananas later. I don't like being judged.
I'll take one dozen bananas, please.
That's actually pretty amazing. I know in sampling some non-alcoholic beers with Ryan that some of them come across as like the hops just don't seem right to me, especially because non-alcoholic IPAs are kind of my wheelhouse. I like IPAs. And so many of them come off as like too floral, like the hops didn't isomerize in a pleasant way, or a way that you're used to and normally expect out of an IPA. And it's been a really tough style, I think, to nail. And Ryan, I'm going to let you chime in here, because I know you said you were really impressed with the Saria IPA.
I've had two of them tonight. They're incredible. Because it actually tastes, I could basically put it in front of somebody else and they wouldn't be able to tell that it's non-alcoholic, because it has enough of that hop flavor that's been transformed during the brewing process. You didn't just add extract at the end to some beverage. It really just tastes full and rounded.
And as a brewmaster, what we do with our beers is we actually dry hop ours. So when you dry hop, that's to me, that's the tried and true method for making an IPA taste the way it should. There are a lot of people out there who use oils. They put the oils in, and that's why it doesn't taste as rounded. There are a bunch out there that just, they have this, either it's too much, too floral, too herbal, just something is not quite finished. They taste okay, but it doesn't taste finished. And ours, we actually take pellets of Amarillo, Cascade, a little bit of Citra, and we actually dry hop our beers. So they are dry hopped. And then we remove all the alcohol down to zero. And yeah, we don't use any oils or anything like that. And it's expensive because you lose a lot of beer. I mean, I talk to the folks at Lagunitas or Stone or Firestone Walker, or any of our local breweries here in Colorado that dry hop, and you'll see that they have huge losses, you know, 15%, 20% losses. And that beer, you can't get it back, but you end up with a fantastic dry hopped IPA. And so that's what we have. And then the other thing we have against us is that when there's no alcohol, alcohol, as you probably know, kills off pathogenic bacteria. So that's what made, in the history of Western civilization, that's why beer has been with us so long, is because beer was made in the early days by the Sumerians, the Egyptians. All the early cultures made beer, but it wasn't high alcohol. It was maybe 1-2% alcohol. It made water safe to drink for everybody, for kids, for families. And so people drank beer, low alcohol beer, because that little bit of alcohol killed off bacteria that could make people sick. Now, when you remove alcohol down to 0.5 or less, you remove that protection of alcohol that kills off pathogenic bacteria that makes people sick. So what you have to do is you have to pasteurize. So our beers, all of them are pasteurized. And when you pasteurized, it's a beer, it's tough because the pasteurization, it tends to dampen the dry hop effect. So you really have to make sure you get the hops right to keep that dry hop flavor after pasteurization. But pasteurization makes it safe for everybody to drink. There are products in the market, non-alcoholic products, that are not pasteurized. And those ones you can recognize right away, because if you just keep the can at room temperature in your garage or anywhere at room temperature, if it's not pasteurized, sometimes you'll see the bottom of the can bulging out because stuff is growing in there. And you have to ask yourself, okay, is it yeast that's re-fermenting? Okay, it's re-fermenting. It's no longer a non-alcoholic beer. There's alcohol in it. Or is it worse? Is it maybe Listeria or E. coli that's gonna kill me? And so that's why there are some non-alcoholic products that say, they have the verbiage right here loud and clear. It says keep cold or keep refrigerated. And when it says that, that's usually the key language that says non-pasteurized. And for those folks, those craft brewers that do that, it's to me, it's a disservice to drinkers, because they're choosing to make a dollar instead of spending that dollar to pasteurize and make that product safe for consumers. So, because the consumer, if they don't want alcohol, they don't want alcohol. They don't want something that's going to re-ferment in the can. And for other consumers, they don't want to get sick. They don't want to pay, you know, $7.99 or $8.99 or $9.99 a six pack, and end up getting sick or worse, dying. So it's so that's why our new labels will actually say pasteurized. It'll be loud and clear. Because to me, one thing I want to really push is the need for pasteurization of non-alcoholic craft beers, because it's just something that has to be done. You can't just do it halfway and say, okay, let's sell this. Because by the way, as a craft brewer, it's you don't pay federal excise tax on a non-alcoholic beer, and you can make money. It's like, to me, it's like never ever skimp like that. You've got to pasteurize to protect your customers, because the last thing the industry needs, the brewing industry, the craft brewing industry needs is to see a craft brewer put something out that makes people sick or worse, kills someone. That's, we just don't need that.
Definitely.
And I should point out that in the juice industry, it's happened. It's here in Colorado, Odwalla Juice. If you just Google Odwalla Juice E. coli, you'll see in the 1990s, they refused to pasteurize their juice because they said, oh, it ruins the flavor of the juice and it ruins the natural nutrition and vitamins in the juice. They said, we're never going to pasteurize. But sure enough, one batch had E. coli and it ended up killing a young girl and making like 60-something people sick. And then after that, they pasteurized. Go figure. It's like, really? That's what it took? You killed somebody and then you pasteurized. And it's like, for me, it's like, you know, never ever take that chance. At Ceria, we pasteurize every can of product we put in the marketplace. So, and we want to make sure that we really convince others to not put that verbiage that says, oh, keep cold, keep refrigerated. It's like, no, you've got to pasteurize. And it's, to me, it's just, I mean, there's no arguments against it. It's like, I'm a scientist, I have a PhD in brewing. To me, it's just, you pasteurize. If you're going to make an NA beer, pasteurize.
And if it's pasteurized, is it then shelf stable? You could keep it warm, you know, room temperature for a fairly indefinite amount of time. Obviously, you don't want to do that for a long time with an IPA because hops degrade over time, but realistically,
correct,
shelf stable.
Correct, yeah. So our products, you can keep at room temperature, and when you're ready to drink them, stick them in the fridge the night before, or the way you can do it real easily is just grab a can and put it, get a bowl with ice and water, throw a little bit of salt in there, and just put the can in and just roll it like this in the salty ice water solution, and within 5 minutes, you'll have an ice-cold beer ready to drink.
I actually have never seen that tip. I'm going to have
get another great advantage to do of that. Aluminum cans.
Yeah. You can do it with an alcoholic product too, but ours are shelf stable, so you can store it in your pantry, in your garage, and then when you're ready to drink, if you want it right away, like I said, just get a bowl of water, ice, salt, spin the beer in there for 5 minutes, and you've got a nice cold beer ready to drink. And there's lots of tricks to drinking beer.
as you pointed out, it's not a new product.
Right. And by the way, I'm a beer doctor. So,
well, Keith, is there anything about your book and Ceria that you want our listeners to know about that we haven't covered?
Yeah, I think one thing I've heard from people is they didn't realize the history of cannabis, and they've read the first chapter and said, wow, I didn't realize that cannabis has been here for a long time. It was made illegal because of political and racial reasons, not because it was thoroughly studied and found to be addictive. By any means, it was not. And also, there's so much promise with the plant. So in there, I give a picture of a car from 1941 where Henry Ford actually made a car, the body panels, out of bioplastics. I mean, here in 2021, we say bioplastics, and everybody says, oh, yeah, that, you know, bioplastics, yeah. You can make plastics out of plants. But Henry Ford did it in 1941 using soybeans and hemp and a couple other plants, but he made body panels built a car. It was a test car. And they, some people refer to it as the soybean car. I think that's the official name. Other people call it the hemp car. But it's a car that was, the body panels were made out of bioplastics. And it was like so amazing, but it was 1941. And then, of course, with World War II, they scrapped everything and never started that research again. But it is fascinating because now, here in 2021, you see Formula One race cars with bioplastic body panels. Porsche has one, and it's just absolutely amazing. that American ingenuity back in 1941 had bioplastics. And to me, the sad part is that it was federally illegal. And so that type of research to make bioplastics, to make medicines, all that never happened over the course of the illegal period of cannabis. I mean, that's, think of all the things in society that could have been made better if cannabis was not made illegal. Medicines, bioplastics, just lots of different things. It's just to me, it's sad, but what happened. We just have to look at the future. And in the book, I talk about some of the future things that people might think about when it becomes legal. I talk about the fact that you can make medicines. You can, in the future, you can clone these genes for cannabinoids into plants. So you can have beers with hops that have cannabinoids, or you can clone it into vegetables. So you've got vegetables ready with medicines in them for people who want to have something happen that has to happen. I mean, it sounds like Frankenscience, kind of, but I think the help that it offers is much greater than the scary part. And certainly when you see, kids with problems that can be helped, like kids with seizures, and if they just need CBD, why not have snacks for them that have, maybe it was sugar cane that has CBD gene in that sugar cane. And so they've got these nice little snacks they can eat, and all of a sudden their seizures go away. So there's just so much potential in the future. But at the end of the day, though, I think the big thing for homebrewers is to experiment carefully and take as many notes as possible. And if you find something really cool, try to report it out to Zymergy or something, so that all of us learn. Because all of us as homebrewers and as beer drinkers, if there's something cool, we should learn. And also, if one of your listeners happens to come up with a really cool thing that works, it's like, okay, you can't patent anything with cannabis at this point, but if you start a small business, when it does become federally legal, you just may get a knock on your door from a big pharmaceutical company, a big brewing company, maybe even a big soft drink company. And they say, hey, you've got a cool thing there. Can I buy it for you for 20 million, 30 million? And who knows, one of your listeners may do that and become a millionaire. It happened up in Canada with legalization up there. You saw people become billionaires, millionaires, because it's a once in a lifetime opportunity when you have something that's been illegal for decades, all of a sudden become legal. So who knows, maybe even Josh might come up with a cool thing, and all of a sudden he sends us a postcard from his own private island in the Pacific, and it's like, oh, hey guys. So yeah, the possibilities are almost endless. So the future is, you can tell I'm an optimist, but I'm also passionate about beer and cannabis, because I think there's so much to be had there. One reason for the book also is just that maybe one of your listeners might find an idea to work with and help advance humanity, but at the same time, make a decent payday from it. And I'm talking, maybe they may get a check for $5 million, $10 million, $20 million, $100 million. Because to big corporations, that's just a small investment for a product that can make them billions of dollars. So, and I know something about, product development, because with Blue Moon, I developed that from nothing. It became $1 billion a year product. It's a big, big brand, like Budweiser, like Miller. In the news today, it was they talked about New Glarus out of Wisconsin. I mean, and they talked about the millions of dollars of profit that they make. So craft brewers, they make a lot of money. So why not home brewers experimenting and make a few million? It's what's fair is fair.
definitely worth a shot.
There you go, listeners. $1 million ideas.
Given away on Focus on the Beer. Well, Keith, we're gonna wrap the show up here. But I just wanted to thank you for coming on the show. I'm going to implore everyone to go out and get this book, because Josh and I have read it, and it is fascinating. It is super interesting. Everything from history to regulatory to legal to the recipes in the back. It's a pretty quick read. So if you're like worried about it being a long book, there's a lot of really easy to digest information. It's not this super dense textbook of sorts.
Yeah, unlike some of the other Brewers publication things that have gotten a little really super techy, Keith makes it really easy for people to understand the concepts, you know, really makes it accessible, and that's one of the big merits of the book in my mind as well. So thank you again, Keith, for the book and for spending time with us today.
Well, thanks, Josh, and thanks, Ryan. Yeah, it's been fun. And again, I hope your readers get something, or your listeners get something out of this, and I truly hope they have some fun with it. But again, take caution, because you know, there's a lot of unknowns. But please, to all your listeners, you know, report out if you find something cool. Let us know what happens. Go on Zymergy or any of the homebrew forums and report and say, you know, hey, when I mix this and this, this happens, because there's so many unknowns. But help advance the cause and the science. And if you find something cool, you know, try to make a business out of it. And when it becomes federally legal, you just may have a great payday. So, but yeah, thanks for having me on. And I hope your listeners have some fun with it. And during GABF and Craft Brewers Convention, if we meet up, let's have a beer. Let's have a cannabis beer. And
sounds
have some
good.
Fun.